grieving. Some families will be lost to one another forever. To those of you who face the difficulties of reconnecting with family and establishing ongoing relationships, we say sorry. We offer this apology in the hope that it will assist your healing and in order to shine a light on a dark period of our nation's history. To those who have fought for the truth to be heard, we hear you now.
You're listening to Adopt Perspective, a podcast for anyone affected by adoption. I'm one of your hosts, Jo Sparrow. This podcast is a production of Jigsaw Queensland Post-Adoption Support Service. However, the views expressed are those of the people participating, not necessarily Jigsaw Queensland. The podcast discusses adult themes and listener discretion is advised. Welcome to Adopt Perspective. I'm your host and president of Jigsaw Queensland, Jo Sparrow. Today's guest is Dr. Giselle Newton, if I can get it out, a postdoctoral research fellow at the University of Queensland. She's a digital health sociologist whose research is focused on understanding how reproductive and genetic technologies reshape personal and familial relationships and considers how people with lived experience participate and position themselves in research, policy reform, and development of support and services. As a donor-conceived person herself, Giselle's research is grounded in advocacy regarding access to information and family and health for all donor-conceived people worldwide. Welcome to Adopt Perspective, Giselle. I'm so happy to have you join us.
Thanks so much, Jo. It's a pleasure to be here.
Giselle, is your experience as a donor-conceived person what drew you to research in this area?
Yeah, certainly. I was doing some study prior to starting my PhD study on, I was really interested in how people discussed health online on social media. And what I found was these very kind of niche communities of different health issues, different health conditions, people discussing contraceptive options, all different small communities where there's these interesting patterns of bonding occurring. And I wanted to extend that work and look at something that was really relevant to me in my life, because I'd noticed that since I joined a Facebook group for donor-conceived people back in around 2012, when I was around 18, I think. And I was struck by how much people supported each other, gave advice, gave information, would spend a lot of time creating these really long texts responding to other people that essentially they didn't know online. And so I was keen to start a PhD study looking at donor-conceived people's experiences. And what I learned at that time was that there was relatively little amount of research on donor conception in Australia, especially with donor-conceived people themselves. There's been a little bit with recipient parents and with donors, but less with donor-conceived people. And I think as a donor-conceived person myself, embedded within these communities, I was kind of positioned in a particular way to recruit participants for the study, but also brought a different viewpoint to research questions and to interpretation and analysis. So certainly my own positionality as donor-conceived person was key in beginning the research.
Yeah, sure. Would you mind if I asked you to share a little bit about your personal experience as a donor-conceived person?
Sure. So I was conceived in the Northern Territory. My mother was working at Darwin Public Hospital. And my heterosexual parents were having troubles having children. And there was a doctor there at the time who suggested that they could try artificial insemination or donor conception. And it was very low-key back in those days. It wasn't like today where you kind of have these profiles and you know a lot about the donor. In some instances, people choose a person that they know in their ordinary everyday life. Back then it was they tried to do what they called sperm matching, which was choosing a donor that looked a little bit like your dad. So they chose someone, the doctor chose someone. And again, that's slightly different because usually it would be the patient today. And that sperm was sent from Western Australia to the Northern Territory. So across kind of jurisdictions. And after several attempts, they were successful, and I was born in New South Wales, in a different jurisdiction. And I grew up knowing that I was donor conceived my whole life. So contrary to the advice of the doctors at the time, which was to not tell your children because they thought that it would be harmful to a child to learn that information, my parents thought that keeping a secret was not going to be healthy and was not a good approach to parenting. So they decided they would always tell me. And the way that they did that was building up a narrative about, you know, when I was very small, about being very special and about how difficult it was to have a baby. And then, you know, as I was reaching puberty, really going more into the detail of how you do conceive via donor conception. So I think what we've learned as well from the research is that approach of slowly building up a story so it's never a shock or never a surprise is really key for donor conceived people.
Yeah, for sure. It's always, it doesn't surprise me, but it always confirms what I think, that there's so much crossover between donor conceived people and adoption in many aspects. And that's one of them. Late discovery is always a big shock to adopted people. It can have really terrible ramifications on their life.
Yeah. So I guess it's the kind of part of the early days. And then, as I mentioned, like my late teens and early adult years, I became increasingly interested, and my parents weren't against me seeking more information. I knew that it was a sensitive issue, particularly for my dad. And there are kinds of, like, there wasn't a lot of counselling for parents at that time, as I've said. So I've always been conscious of those sensitivities. So I joined a Facebook group and kind of was able to connect with other donor-conceived people, found that there were some pathways to accessing information. But then in kind of, the mid-2010s, DNA, direct-to-consumer DNA testing really became, it became obvious that it was key in donor conception. And I, around 2017, 2018, decided to take a DNA test and was able to identify initially, after a few months after testing, a half-sibling, a donor-conceived brother who I met. And more recently, just this year actually, I reached out via Facebook to somebody who I believe to be my first cousin, so my donor's nephew, and he's been able to offer some information about who he thinks the donor is, and I'm sort of at that stage of working out how to contact the donor, which is something that, as I'm sure you've thought a lot about, Joe, is, you know, these decisions can take a long time, and lots of people in my life say to me, well, why don't you just go and do it? And there's many reasons to go and do it, and other reasons why it's, for me, important to kind of sit and let that settle and think about it a little bit longer.
Yeah, really excellent approach, Giselle. It's definitely something I can understand and have had a lot of experience with myself. Yeah.
So I guess that's a broader overview of, across the life. Yeah.
That's fantastic. And I just loved, I love that you are someone with lived experience who is now researching and paving the way for us to understand this whole world of donor conception so much better.
Yeah, it's an exciting role to be in that comes with a lot of responsibility when you work with your own community, which I'm sure you're also very familiar with.
Yeah. So what research projects have you already undertaken in relation to donor conception?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, my PhD study really looked at how digital technologies are creating new opportunities for donor-conceived people. So that was a four-year project, a mixed methods kind of project. So there was a national online survey, there was semi-structured interviews, there was some policy analysis of the inquiry into donor conception in Australia. And really what that thesis found was that donor-conceived people use digital technologies in four key ways. So the first one is to bond around shared experiences, particularly in online Facebook groups. The second is to sleuth, so using DNA testing to kind of identify family members. Thirdly, donor-conceived people use digital technologies to strategize for reform to the legislation, So across Australia, we're seeing a lot of reform, a lot of inquiries following the Victorian inquiry, which was the first jurisdiction in the world to give retrospective access to information for donor-conceived people. So that really prioritised the rights of the donor-conceived person over the rights of, for example, donors, which is... some people would suggest is quite a controversial move. But I guess it's worth also thinking about how it was really doctors that were promising anonymity to donors rather than that always being a legal agreement. Mm-hmm. So DNA digital technologies for bonding, strategizing, sleuthing, and for connecting amongst donor-conceived people. So that was that research project. And now, I guess, beyond that project, I've been doing another project. I'm now at the University of Queensland. My current project has been focused on DNA testing and looking beyond the donor-conceived community to adoptees, to donors, to recipient parents, also to family history, people interested in family history and genealogy. So really looking across a broader set of experiences and thinking about people's experiences of taking a DNA test, their motivations to take a DNA test, and the kinds of ways they think about privacy and consent, how they think about the future of the platform. So my research is kind of between media studies and communication and also sociology. So really interested in that cross section or the intersection of the digital, but also human experiences and relationships. So there's been some really interesting initial insights from that project. I've been thinking a lot about DNA discoveries or DNA disruptions and how this causes very intense emotions and affinity sensations. So I'm currently working on a piece around three characters in particular, three participants whose stories have this potency of unexpected familial relationships that emerge following DNA testing. And then I'm also interested in how the family becomes visible or some family members become invisible via DNA testing platforms. So social family largely becomes invisible because not connected by DNA. And what this means, what these digital technologies then mean for how we think about and understand the family.
Yeah, so interesting. I can't wait till it all comes out. Where are you at with the project and when do you hope to have it all finished?
So this DNA project, I finished interviewing participants. So there was around 25 participants in that study. And that study will continue, the analysis and writing up of that study will continue throughout this year. And then I'm looking at starting other studies, another study in particular, focused more on the lived experience aspect of my work. So thinking about how... whether it's donor-conceived people or adoptees, are really in this key position to inform policy and legislation change and how they use that experience in kind of strategic ways. Yeah. So looking to that space as well.
That's really, really important. We have a lot of stakeholders, I think, who would love to get more information and learn the best ways to approach politicians and legislators and use their time most effectively, I guess, when doing that. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that often it's kind of a bit of a black box. We don't really know how these decisions are made, what kinds of stories are persuasive for legislators. So we do know that within donor conception. In fact, a colleague of mine, Ian Smith, who's a former sperm donor, is doing research on kind of stories that persuade policymakers. And he's looking closely at the case of the Victorian legislation that I mentioned earlier and the story of one person in particular, Narelle Gretsch, who had a very serious health condition, bowel cancer, and her story was able to be used in incredibly productive ways to access information about her own conception and set a precedent that that access to information was necessary for all donor conceived people. So that story, a tragic story that led to her death, a very young death, and a preventable death, was incredibly powerful in creating change in donor conception. So, I don't think that there's a formula for legislative or policy change, but what we do know is detailed emotive accounts can really shape people's policy, people in positions of power, their perspectives on important issues.
Yeah, it's so interesting, isn't it? Because yes, that is the kind of thing that shifts people's minds. But then it's also so difficult for the people sharing the story. Like you've kind of got to pop a vein to be able to get people's attention, which is a shame. And having support services available to help people who are sharing their stories, I guess, is really important.
Exactly. As you mentioned, at what expense do people tell their stories? And, you know, if you have to constantly, repeatedly tell the stories in a particular way, then in a very emotional kind of way, this does take a toll on people with lived experience. And we really have to understand that process a little better from a research perspective.
Yeah, definitely. So in your research, you've also been interested in how donor-conceived people participate in advocacy and policy reform, and you do talk about that concept of lived experience. Could you tell us a little bit about what that is exactly?
Yeah, so I guess that's lived experience is relevant to kind of these kind of health and identity groups where having lived through a particular health condition or identity experience puts you in a particular position to inform policy, legislation, the development of services and support for that group of people. But what we're seeing is that people with lived experience are also really upskilling and in different ways. So by reaching out to their peers and getting a better understanding of their peers' experience through formal education, studying the issue in question, through becoming familiar with policy documents or laws. So really upskilling and getting a broader understanding that allows them to position themselves as people with authority to be able to respond to questions that policymakers pose. And so we see this shift from lived experience to what I've argued is more of a lived expertise, when you can position yourself in a position of authority to convince legislators. So as I mentioned earlier, I looked at the case of the National Inquiry into Donor Conception, and really there were a range of witnesses that spoke and gave evidence at that inquiry. Some of those were doctors, medical professionals, donor-conceived people themselves spoke. And it was interesting to me, the analysis found that donor-conceived people really positioned themselves as equal to those medical professionals and were able to underscore why the evidence of the medical professionals wasn't entirely accurate and wasn't entirely justifiable in the ways that they thought about the legislative reform. So they were positioning themselves in these interesting ways. I think it's undeniable that medical professionals have a certain status and authority in those kinds of contexts based on their education and expertise. But people with lived experience are also now able to position themselves as people with authority. I think this is, a really interesting space to be working in today.
Yeah, for sure. Just speaking of legislation and where things are going, there's been some movements in a few states with regards to donor conception, particularly South Australia and Queensland. Can you give us any updates on where things stand now?
Yeah, so there have been a number of inquiries in recent years in Western Australia in 2018, and we're still waiting for the changes on that. In South Australia, a couple of years later. So the South Australian case has just gone through Parliament. It's not finished. That process is not complete. But it looks like there will be very strong legislative reform in South Australia following Victoria and even improving on Victoria. So that's very exciting. As far as I understand, there have been some promises for kind of a digital donor conception register, which would allow people to, you know, it's very 21st century up along with the times rather than having a kind of more a system in which the register is held within a department, a health department, mm-hmm. or an attorney general's department, birth, deaths and marriages. So it's having a digital register is incredibly important as far as I understand. And for being able to access that information, being able to provide information to other parties, other stakeholders, such as between donor conceived people and their siblings or between donor conceived people and their donor, if the donor's had a health issue, that being able to report that to an online register or an online portal is incredibly important. So yeah, it's been very impressive the way the South Australian government's gone about that legislative reform and really consulting on an ongoing basis with donor conceived people. In Queensland, we're currently seeing in 2022 there was an inquiry. Queensland has no legislation on donor conception. So what we're seeing is the state government looking to better regulate the assisted reproduction technologies industry, which is necessary to ensure that gametes such as sperm and eggs are not being used for too many families beyond the family limits, to ensure that gametes or donors with health issues are not being used, to ensure a range of issues that are not being adequately regulated in Queensland, because Queensland is currently governed by national guidelines, which do not really to a sufficient extent ensure that assisted reproductive technologies are regulated. So we're seeing that on one hand, assisted reproductive technologies are being the Queensland government is looking to regulate them better. And on the other hand, we also see following the inquiry that the Queensland government is looking to create a donor conception register. And following recommendations, that register looks like it will be housed within births, deaths and marriages, which really, in my opinion, is the best place for a donor conception register, because being donor conceived is not a health issue or a health condition. It's an identity issue. And in my opinion, your donor conceived status should be listed on your birth certificate, because that ensures that all parents disclose to their child that they're donor conceived and that there's additional information that the state holds regarding their conception. So again, really promising developments in Queensland. The Australian Capital Territory is also looking to create a donor conception register. So there's movement there. I think the remaining jurisdictions are Tasmania and the Northern Territory, which don't have any. Tasmania did have an inquiry, but didn't make any progress with their legislation, and the Northern Territory doesn't have anything. So those states are really lagging behind and should be stepping up. And there's also been calls for a national register on donor conception, because we know that people move between states and territories. We know that donors move between states and territories. People go overseas. And gametes are being imported to Australia from overseas. So having a national register would really be a more effective system, but that does take time and cooperation between states.
Seeing so much movement in this space just tells me what an incredible effort everyone who's been advocating for these changes with lived experience. I know it takes a toll on people. It's hard work and it can be disappointing and frustrating and involves sharing your stories. And I just want to congratulate everybody who's been working so hard. And I hope that we see movement on all of those areas very soon.
Yeah, we're really, I feel that following the paths of, you know, giants in this space, the likes of Damien Adams and Lauren Burns, who for decades now have been advocating on donor conception. And so we see these waves of people who have energy and drive to execute a certain amount of reform, and understandably that takes a huge toll, and those people kind of move back and create more space for other people to kind of work on the issues. And so I think that's a real strength of the donor conceived community, is that there are these different generations of advocates. And it is a bigger community today, you know, with DNA testing, with more public awareness around donor conception, more people are kind of coming out of the woodworks and joining the Facebook groups. And so that means it's a bigger community, which is a strength, but it also means that communication and diversity in experiences is you know, these are issues that we have to kind of work out how to manage. And so we're looking, so a key kind of moment in donor conception was a conference that was held in 2015, and Donor Conception RUDC, Are You Donor Conceived conference. Mm-hmm. And so we're looking to have a second, a 2.0 of that conference later this year. So that would be, I think, you know, meeting other donor conceived people in a face-to-face context is really a unique experience and something that not all donor conceived people get to experience, because it is quite an uncommon experience. So yeah, that would be an important moment, I think.
That would be incredible. I mean, it's like a massive peer support, isn't it?
Exactly,
it's
yeah.
Just incredible to meet people who've got an experience similar to yours.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really powerful.
Look, thank you so much for joining us, Giselle. And like I said, we hope to hear some news of legislative changes very soon, and particularly in Queensland, since we're here. Before, hopefully, we get a change of government perhaps very soon. So
yeah, I'm really hoping that all goes through before the end of this election period. Yes.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much for your time, Jo. Talk soon.
And I'll put up some relevant links on our podcast notes page. And thank you to our listeners for joining us. Meanwhile, if you have a story that you'd like to share with us and you'd like to be interviewed for the podcast, just jump onto the main podcast page of the Jigsaw Queensland website and complete the prospective guest form that you'll find there. And just note that Adopt Perspective can be and is listened to by people all over the world. Bye for now.
Thanks for listening to the Adopt Perspective podcast. If you'd like to find out more, go to the podcast page on www.jigsawqueensland.com and you'll find a wealth of information and resources on the website. If you reside in Queensland, you can reach Jigsaw Queensland's Forced Adoption Support Service on toll-free 1800 210313, or you can call Jigsaw on 07 33 58 6666. If you live in another state of Australia, you can still call the Forced Adoption Support Service number, and your call will be answered by the Forced Adoption Support Service in the state that you're calling from. In every other state, Relationships Australia operates this service. A big thank you to Matt Sparrow for composing and recording our original theme music. Until next time, I'm Jo Sparrow, saying farewell from Adopt Perspective, a podcast for anyone affected by adoption. Thank you.